Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, April 12th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who joins us here today, whether you're listening live or listening through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people and using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are gratefully available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the red and white bullseye, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work, the Reality Management Worksheet. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself, which is a tool I have been using for over 16 years now to improve my life, manage my emotions, and turn any negative emotion into part of the infallible guidance system that each of us was given. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have been stepped through the worksheet process or called to ask clarifying questions about it, or given powerful testimonials about the positive impact of actually applying this tool in their lives. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet process, an abbreviated version of that process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we encourage people to do that soon and often, because when they do, it usually raises questions. And that's one of the primary reasons we're here 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, in our current format. So you can give us a call at 563-999-3581. And press 1, and it'll put a little question mark by your phone number. And in turn, I will turn on your microphone, and we can have a conversation. This is the 102nd day of the year, and we are doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons. Today's lesson reads, I will share God's will for my happiness. And in the previous two lessons for the weekend, the lessons were fairly short, and Saturday's lesson read, my part is essential to God's plan for salvation, because we're all part of this creation. And then yesterday's lesson read, God's will for me is perfect happiness. Again, as I learn to accept and allow the flow of life and then decide to add only positive emotional energy and positive impact to that flow of life energy, everything gets better because we're connected to everyone and everything. Today's lesson is, I share God's will for my happiness, for happiness for me. The commentary reads, you do not want to suffer. You may think it buys you something, and may still believe a little that it buys you what you want. Yet, this belief is surely shaken now, at least enough to let you question it and to suspect that it really makes no sense. That belief hasn't gone as yet, but it lacks the roots that once secured it tightly to the dark and secret hidden places of your mind. Today we try to loosen its weakened hold still further and to realize that pain is purposeless without a cause and with no power to accomplish anything. It cannot purchase anything at all. Pain offers nothing and does not exist, and everything you think it offers you is lacking in existence like itself. You've been a slave to nothing. Be you free today to join the happy will of the Creator. For several days, we will continue to devote our periods of practicing to exercises planned to help you reach the happiness God's will has planned and placed in you. Here is your home, and here is your safety. Here is your peace, and here there is no fear. Here is salvation. Here is rest at last. Begin your practice periods today with this acceptance of the Creator's will for you. I share the Creator's will for happiness for me, and I accept it as my function now. Then seek this function deep within your mind, for it is there, awaiting but your choice. You cannot fail to find it when you learn it is your choice and that you share the Creator's will. Be happy, for your only function here is happiness. You have no need to be less loving to creation's offspring than he whose love created him as loving as himself. Besides these hourly 5-minute rests, pause frequently today to tell yourself that you have now accepted happiness as your one function, and be sure that you are joining with the Creator's will in doing this. I share God's will for happiness for me, and I accept it as my function now. Pam Grout's book, A Course in Miracles Experiment, Chapter 102, reads, "Old beliefs are going down." She quotes Ludwig Bemelman as saying, "And to the tiger in the zoo, Madeline just said, poo-poo." Pam writes, "NPR recently ran a report about Madeline, Ludwig Bemelman's plucky heroine, who you may remember lives in, quote, an old house in Paris covered in vines, close quote. I read all the Madeline books to my daughter when she was young. We both loved them. Being reminded of Madeline's courageous poo-poo to the tiger in the zoo made me smile, because that's exactly what Lesson 102, I share the dude's will for my happiness, that's exactly what this lesson tells me to say to old belief systems that so insistently wave their hands in the back of the classroom. Those beliefs that are on constant alert, looking for ways to sabotage my happiness. The old beliefs are stubborn. They claim to be working on my behalf. They adamantly insist they're keeping things in control so I can be happy. That tired old belief system is relentless, telling me that there's always some violation, some person out there who is messing up, who's doing it wrong. Of course, it's never me. So today, as I channel Madeline and brush aside the scary tiger and all my other judgments, I realize there's no reason to delay, no reason to limit, no reason to wait an instant longer for the endless peace and joy and miracles to which I am entitled. 5 minutes every hour, I will remember. I share creation's will for my happiness. So that's our Course in Miracles lesson for today and the corollary reading from Pam Grout's book, A Course in Miracles Experiment. And we have 49 minutes left for conversation, 563-999-3581, and press 1. How can we support you today? I'm struck by synchronicity at times because the another book that I've been reading as I go along with this one is the Untamed by Glennon Doyle. And near the end, she has a whole segment about control and it's resonating in my mind with this lesson and the idea that when I align with that flow of life and the Creator's will for the way life is unfolding and assume that my purpose is to be happy, then oddly things work out. The section of her book is titled Seconds. And she writes, sometimes when heated conflict arises between my wife Abby and me, we stop talking, we take a breath and say to each other, quote, okay, let's not first marriage this, let's second marriage this, close quotes. What we mean is, let's not go on autopilot here. Let's use what we've learned and apply it. Let's be careful and wise and put our egos aside and remember that we are on the same team. Now that we know better, let's do better. I would have described myself as the spiritual director of my first marriage. I had the vision for our plot, and my husband screwed it up. I now understand that this is because each person has their own plot. No one can be a supporting actor in someone else's storyline. They can pretend to, but they will always have subplots brewing inside and unfolding on the outside. I am very controlling. I want to control things. This is because I am afraid. Things feel so precarious. When I was young, I made myself feel safer by controlling my food and body. I still do that. But as I got older and became a wife and mother, I found another thing to try to control to create safety, my people. Since life is scary and precarious, controlling people I love felt like the responsible thing to do. In addition to the fear factor, there is something else that leads me to want to control things, and that is my belief that I am very smart and creative. I really do believe I have very good ideas and that people would do best if they got on board. This kind of control I call leadership. For a long while, I have controlled and led my people and called that love. I, quote, loved, close quote, my people to a bloody pulp. My role in the lives of the people I love has been as follows. Quote, I exist to make all your hopes and dreams come true, so let's sit down and take a look at this comprehensive list of hopes and dreams I have created for you. I've been paying very close attention, and trust me, I see you, and I know better than you know yourself. I know you better than you know yourself. You can do anything I put your mind to. So let's begin, close quotes. But in truth, we cannot feel and know and imagine for another person. This is what I'm trying to understand. The person who is teaching me this is my wife. My wife is uncontrollable. I love my wife more wildly than I have ever loved a grown human in my life. Before I met her, I wasn't even all that afraid of dying. Now, the thought of death panics me daily, not because of death itself, but because of the idea of not being with her. Death, to me, is just the ultimate FOMA, fear of missing Abby. Since I love Abby the most, it follows that I have to control her the most. I want to make all of my dreams for her come true. I just really want my best for her. So to that end, I have relentless good ideas to share with her about what she should do and where and eat and how she should work and sleep and read and listen. But every time I try to share my good ideas, overtly or covertly, she somehow knows what I'm doing and calls me out on it. And categorically, she rejects my efforts. She does this gently. She says things like, "I see what you're doing there, babe. I love you for the effort, but no. Thank you, I'm good." For the first year of our marriage, I assumed that this was just a fresh, exciting challenge. I assumed that my job was to find new ways to approach her. Here's an actual conversation with my sister during my first year of marriage in response to the problem of my wife Abby's continuing to insist that she was the boss of herself. Me: "Okay, I hear you, but what if I actually know that my idea is better for her than her idea is for her? Should I just pretend to think her idea is good? Should I just smile and let her try her idea so we can get to mine when hers doesn't work so well? How long will I have to carry on with this time-wasting charade?" My sister replied, "Oh, my God. Okay, Glennon, if that's how you have to think of it, then yes, try that. Try to fake it until you make it." So that is what I did. I just smiled and faked it. I let her lead, but only because it was my undercover leadership strategy. I decided that we would try things her way for a while until we both saw the light together. For a solid year, we were spontaneous when I preferred a plan. We were trusting of people when I was skeptical. We took big risks even when I had already calculated that the odds were against us. We let the kids try things I was sure they'd fail at and then resent us forever. We lived for a while as if life were less precarious than it is, as if people were better than they are, as if our kids were tougher than I believed them to be, and as if, quote, "things generally work themselves out," close quotes. It was reckless and ridiculous and irresponsible. Things do not work themselves out. I work them out. I work them out. And if I don't, there is no working out at all. There's just chaos. I took lots of deep breaths and started a daily yoga practice to deal with my anxiety, and I waited for things to fall apart so I could save us. I kept waiting. Damned if things didn't generally just keep working out. Damned if I didn't start to feel happier. Damned if our children didn't become braver, kinder, and more relaxed. Damned if life didn't just get more beautiful. It was annoying as hell, honestly. I really think that it is possible now that Abby has good ideas. I'm beginning to unlearn what I used to believe about control and love. Now I think that maybe control is not love. I think that control might actually be the opposite of love, because control leaves no room for trust, and maybe love without trust is no love at all. I'm beginning to play with the idea that love is trusting that other people feel, know, and imagine things too. Maybe love is respecting what your people feel, trusting what they know, and believing that they have their own unseen order for their lives pressing through their own skin. Maybe my role with the people I love is not imagining the truest, most beautiful life for them, then pushing them toward it. Maybe I'm supposed to ask what they feel and know and imagine. And then, no matter how different their unseen order is from mine, ask them what I can do to support their vision. Trusting people is terrifying. Maybe if love is not a little scary and out of our control, then it is not love at all. It is wild to let others be wild. Over the weekend, I was wrestling with my website and my blog and the redoing the website and getting the blog to post, etc. And so I was finally able to publish a blog post that I had written in response to some conversations last week in group and in patient sessions. The title of the blog post is, "What do you mean all events are neutral?" And I wrote, "In the work we do in MindShifter support groups and on MindShifter's radio podcast, our main focus is on observing how we create our emotions and our responses to the events that unfold in our world. The goal is for me to be able to accept 100% responsibility for the emotions and reactions I create. Part of the observation in this process is to realize the capital T truth taught in most spiritual and philosophic tradition. Quote, all events are neutral, close quotes. Shakespeare has Hamlet say, why then, 'tis none to you, for there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Also in the Way of Mastery, the Way of the Heart, Lesson 9, is titled, quote, all events are neutral, close quotes. I found myself on the MindShifters radio podcast the other day saying, you will never walk into the forest and walk right into a cloud of fear the way you can walk into a cloud of gnats or a cloud of mosquitoes or a fog bank. This is because fear does not exist outside of the human mind that creates it. The human who walks into the forest or wherever brings the fear-creating device with them into that situation. That fear-creating device is the conscious, rational, logical mind, that part of our mind that does what David Bohm calls sustained incoherence. By creating our negative emotional states and then blaming them on something outside of itself, then deciding to think its way to a solution using the very process that created the problem. Byron Katie in her work and her books talks about how it is possible to look at everything that happens as though it is perfect, just the way it is. How can you know this? Because it happened. There is no going back into the past to change what happened. So when I argue with it, when I say it shouldn't have happened, when I label it bad or tragic, I'm creating more pain for myself. And I'm focusing on things I cannot control. Michael Singer teaches us that the physical universe, as we experience it, has been moving through the creative process, according to the best estimates of our scientists, for 13.8 billion years. Yes, every atom, molecule, organism, structure, person you have ever had contact with is the result of the process of creation unfolding since the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. Everything is unfolding in that creative process. And when a human mind decides to label that process or its results as bad, wrong, or tragic, that takes a special kind of arrogance. It also guarantees additional pain and frustration, since the human mind is not going to be able to undo what creation has done. Here are some of the comments and arguments we often hear when this topic comes up. Oh, so what then? We're just supposed to sit back and do nothing? Oh, so we should just allow things and everything that we see unfold and never take a corrective action? Well, then, if all events are neutral, why would we do anything to change anything at all? Well, what is the point of life if we just sit back and watch and never make a judgment or try to take a corrective action? Well, this philosophy would lead to the destruction of society as we know it and even greater pain and suffering. I have heard each of these reactions and many more. The point of this teaching, all events are neutral, is to recognize that the external events in our lives do not create our emotions, and they do not create our experience of life. Our experience of life is created by the way we choose to interpret and then react to the events in our lives. The capital T truth of this is there to be observed, and yet most of us have been taught the opposite. Most of us have been taught that events are tragic and that what someone else just said is offensive or insulting or hurtful. The capital T truth is that words only have the meanings we give them. And if we choose a neutral interpretation of the events which unfold or the words that are spoken to us, we create a neutral impact. When we choose a negative interpretation, we create a negative impact. Because we are taught the opposite of this, we tend to create perceptions which, quote, prove, close quotes, prove to us that the outside events and actions of others are what creates our emotions and our experience. The capital T truth can be observed is that we are participating in the creation of our experience of life and each of the emotions we feel. When we participate by interpreting the situation negatively and then add a negative emotional energy or defensiveness to the interaction, we make it more intensely negative for ourselves. When we interpret the situation in a neutral or positive way, we will add a positive or constructive energy to the situation and create a more positive experience for ourselves. One of the bottom line observations I teach in my therapy work is, quote, if I have a negative thought about myself or someone else, or a negative emotion that's active in my awareness, I can instantly know three things. The first is, this thought or emotion is a lie or based on a falsehood. The second is, this thought or emotion is an old tape playing in my mind. It's not about the current situation. And the third thing I can know is, if I act from this negative thought or negative emotion, I will simply make my current situation and experience worse. I cannot hope to improve a situation by adding a negative emotional energy to it. So, I invite everyone to experience this for yourself and experiment with it for yourself. Rather than engage in a philosophic argument or even a protracted discussion about whether something is bad or wrong or tragic, etc., simply choose to dismantle the negative emotions, the tension, or judgment that you are creating, in quotes, about that situation. And we teach a host of free tools for doing this on the Mind Shifters Radio podcast. And then when you've restored a state of calm to your mind, you may choose to ask, what is mine to do here? Or how can I assist in this situation? Or how can I bless myself or someone else in this moment? My personal experience has been that this process has dramatically improved my experience of life and resulted in my spending only a tiny fraction of my time in the negative emotional states compared to what I experienced before learning this work and applying this process. We come from love. We are made of love. We are love. Everything else is false. So that's my offering for today, and we have 29 minutes left for comments, conversations, answers, questions, refutations, soliloquies. 563-999-3581. Does it make sense? Why would I read the Untamed work? Why would I add the blog post? Ellen, what's your comment?
Hi, Dr. Tim. Yeah, I just love everything you just said, and I'm in such agreement with you. This lesson today, I didn't really get it so much when I first read it, but when I started practicing it, yeah, I saw, like, I looked back in my mind's eye to when I was a little child and how I experienced all these traumas. They were traumas to me. I really saw how that it was me thinking I shouldn't be treated this way. I should be loved. I should be given affection. And that I've been holding on to this idea, I think pretty much unconsciously, but now I'm really becoming aware of it, that until all of that gets righted, I can't be happy. So I was able to really clearly see that it's myself that has been withholding my happiness from me and not those situations. I mean, they happened. I can't undo them. And there's nothing that needs to be righted. The only thing that needs to happen for me to be happy is to me for me just to let all that go and choose to be happy. And it was just amazing how clear that became to me, that it always is. And it was that one line, I think, in the lesson where it says, recognize that it's your choice to be happy and you know, and finding it. Like, you, how can you not find it when you recognize it's your choice? And that is what really kind of speaks to me, is that no matter what happens, I can choose to be happy. I don't have to wait for the weather to get better or for someone to apologize to me or whatever it is, whatever grievance I've been holding on to. I don't need to wait for, I mean, if I decide I need to wait for any of those things to happen, then I'm making myself unhappy. It's not the situation. I'm doing that. So, yeah, this is just so freeing to have this recognition that it's always my choice.
And if you tap into the Glennon Doyle writing, it is so different as to be, because it's so unique, it tends to be scary at first. It tends to go against everything that we've been conditioned to believe is supposed to be happening or that we should do to allow. We shouldn't allow. We should control and fix and get it right. And yet,
exactly.
That's the very process that creates the vast majority of our pain and suffering.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's so conditioned into us. It is just, it's mind-blowing to recognize that this is so deeply ingrained. I mean, we don't even question it for the most part until we get to a certain point in our spiritual journey and recognize that all this efforting to try and control things is exactly what's kind of hiding your happiness from you. And it's just such a relief.
Yeah, it's a huge leap for most of us where we've been trained to assume that whatever happens is okay, and since it's already happened and I don't have control over that, it is useful for me to shift the focus of my energy to the things I do have some control over, like, okay, what response am I going to choose? How can I get a loving response going here? How can I get positive emotional state flowing in me and add that energy to the life that's unfolding? And it's the opposite of what we're trained to do, so it takes a little practice. And yet many people, Glennon Doyle is just one of them, find out when they commit to that, whether they feel like they're being forced into it or not, they find out that it's far more productive than trying to control things they have no control over. Because the very first thing that happens when I start to try and when I try to control things I have no control over is I create the sense of being out of control. I create that sense of chaos by the very dynamic of focusing on things I have no control over.
And how about things like that you see as flaws that, like I recognized again also this morning that, you know, I live in this, you know, beautiful historic home, but it's got a lot of flaws, you know, it's been lived in for over 100 years and there's so much beauty and yet my mind is always seeking out the flaws instead of focusing on the beauty. And I saw how unproductive that is, what a waste of time that is. But also then I see, oh, this, you know, this needs to be fixed, or even if it's just cosmetic, it doesn't really need to be fixed. But, well, I would like it to look better than that. Just all of those kinds of thoughts create such a burden on me that I can't be happy until that is fixed and I don't have to look at that. It's like, wow, look at that.
Well, if you catch that thought, that's a really good catch.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you, you know, recognize that that's leaving you feeling less than joyful and loving and motivated and productive in the moment, then you might want to practice releasing that thought.
It just feels good for me to release that thought. It's such a relief that, oh, it's not true. It's not true that I'll feel better because I have fixed that. That's not what makes me feel better. Because I've been living my whole life that way.
Yeah. And there are those of us who have been introduced to that pattern of thought earlier in life and realize that, you know, I'll be happy when is a trap.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'll be happy when I get out of grade school. I'll be happy when I get out of high school. I'll be happy when I can drive. I'll be happy when I finally get out of college. I'll be happy when I finally find the right partner and get married. I'll be happy if I finally make it $100,000 a year. Whatever it is, it's an absolute trap.
Yes.
Because it never lasts. Whatever happiness comes, we don't even realize that it's self-generated and it's fleeting because we've tied it to a thing which is temporary. It's one of the other wisdoms from the Way of Mastery that says everything that begins in time ends in time. So everything that is this energy that's been so lowered in it, its vibration as to be perceptible to the senses is going to be in that state for a limited period of time. So if I've tied my happiness to something that has a physical manifestation, then I've tied my happiness to something that is limited in its existence.
Exactly, and this goes right back to the conversation I think we had on Friday about where that real value lies, and it's never in the physical form. It's in the behind, the behind. And so recognizing that and that where it came from can't ever be lost, so it's always available. even if it, you know, it's not appearing, something isn't appearing in form now, it's never lost. It's just gone out of physical appearance, and it's still exactly where it always has been. Just we can't see it now.
Well, and the other aspect of it is to recognize that we are actually capable of creating our emotions moment to moment. One of the teachings from Abraham says, your most important creation in each moment is your emotion in that moment. Another of those teachings says, if you think about why you want something, anything, it's because of the emotional state you plan to experience once you get it, whether it's
the
partner or the house or the car or whatever. And, you know, to bridge into some of Guy Finley's teachings, he says, listen, how can the thing that's responsible for your happiness in that same instant be responsible for creating your fear? Because if you tie your happiness to getting this thing or that, then as soon as you get it, you have to be afraid that you might lose it, and you have to get defensive and protective. So back to Abraham, Abraham says, rather than thinking about getting this thing so you can have this feeling, look for the feeling you want to have when that thing happens and create that feeling in your life today. Then if you still want that thing, that car, that relationship, that dwelling, etc., go get it. But then you will know with great certainty that your happiness with this good feeling, this satisfying emotion, this sense of gratification is not tied to that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you won't be terrified of losing it.
Right.
The thing comes and goes, and you're fine because your emotional state, your satisfaction, your happiness, your purpose in life is not tied to that thing which comes and goes. So if I can learn at greater and greater levels to realize that whatever unfolds is perfect the way it unfolds, and what is mine to do is to choose the emotion that I experience in response to that and the action I take in response to that. And when I recognize that that's happening and I'm always choosing to add to whatever unfolds around me, and my choice is really, do I add a happy, loving, positive, productive energy to this unfolding of life around me, or do I add a judging, restricted, angry, bitter, resentful energy to it? And when I wake up to that, for me, the choice becomes very, very easy.
Mm-hmm.
But if I think, as the Glennon Doyle writing was talking about, that I know what's best for life, I know what's best for other people, I know how things should be happening, and this isn't it, then I don't get to go with the flow, and I don't have the option of allowing and surrendering and then adding positive energy to the events. Because I'm busy fighting against it. I'm busy labeling it as bad or wrong or tragic or catastrophic. And in that label, my response is already predetermined. Right? If it's bad, if it's negative, it's catastrophic and tragic, then I have to fight against it. Then I have to add negative emotions to it.
Putting the label on it is key. I mean, what I choose to call something. You know, and so I just recognize now that no matter what happens, it's exactly what's in my best interest. And I have no idea what my best interest is. That's one of the teachings from the Course that I love so much. You can't possibly know. So just trust that whatever comes, that's in your best interest. Say, oh, okay. And I don't have to know why. Maybe at some point I'll see why, you know, it'll become clear to me, but I don't have to know why.
Yeah, and it's okay if I never understand why.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot more going on here than my conscious logical mind will ever comprehend.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just railing against something last week that suddenly today I realized, wow, what a blessing that was. It's so wonderful. Just, you know, catching ourselves doing it so that it doesn't last for any longer. You know, like what Pam Grout was saying in the reading you did from her book today. I need not wait a moment longer. But I have to have that recognition. And then once I have the recognition, then it's like, okay, put an end to it right there. I was reading in Byron Katie's book that people tell her that, you know, like her truth, which is that, you know, God is good and God is everything. God is reality. People say, well, it can't be, you know, it can't be that simple. And she's like, hey, you know, if you make that your last story, have a wonderful life. You know, to believe anything else is to have some pain and suffering in your life. So I like that, make that your last story, you know, because she says in the end, even that isn't true, but hey, live with that. Live with that as your story. Everything is good. Everything comes from God and everything is good. And try that one on. See how that one feels. You know, certainly
yeah,
the story I've been living with, that this and this and that and the other thing shouldn't be happening, shouldn't have happened, shouldn't have, whatever, that story certainly doesn't feel good, so why not try something else?
Yeah, and the thing that we aren't taught that is so important to learn is that it is the choice of story, of interpretation
mm-hmm.
and meaning and then choice of response that is what creates my experience of life, not the actual flow of life, because
exactly.
I am so many levels removed from the actual flow. And I'm removed from it by the thoughts and the conscious logical mind and the judgments and the control efforts. And we aren't taught that that's what's removing me from the flow. We aren't taught that that very process that I think is going to lead to my joy and happiness and satisfaction and safety is the thing that's creating my suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the primary keys in this work for me.
Yeah, and I was seeing
to
how...
To observe that process.
Yeah. And I was seeing how, like, all the flaws that my eyes, you know, want to seek out. Like, I always had this, like, kind of underpinning belief that they somehow reflected on me. And that was my great need to fix all the flaws, because if there's a flaw out there, there must be a flaw in here. So seeing that, wow, it simply isn't true. And that if other people, you know, see the flaws, then that's going to be then they're going to think badly of me, just the way I was thinking badly of me. And it's just amazing how punishing that is. And we do it or at least I was doing it without even recognizing it. And there's no, like the lesson, today's lesson says, there's no cause for any of that.
Yeah, in the absolute sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the cause for my experience of life and all my emotions is inside me, which is the opposite of what my culture teaches me.
Right.
One of the teachings from the Way of Mastery is all events are neutral. My thoughts about those events are not neutral at all, but the events themselves are neutral. But I'm going to create my experience of life with those thoughts.
Right.
Mike Dooley says, thoughts become things, so choose the good ones.
Yeah. Well, one of the lessons in the course earlier on was, I have no neutral thoughts.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's just becoming more and more clear to me. And the recognition, yes, those thoughts are what is creating my experience. Nothing that is life happening is creating my experience of life happening. Just my thinking about it.
Yep, nothing either is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so.
Yeah.
So, any other comment or question that we can entertain for you today?
No, I just wanted to chime in and thank you for everything that you said. It's just, you know, it's just very in line with where I'm at right now, and I appreciate it's almost like everything that I was recognizing this morning, then you kind of like stated it all. So I appreciate that. It just reconfirms, you know, because sometimes all the realizations and things that I'll get, I usually are in the morning, and then by late afternoon, evening, I've forgotten them all. Like they're just gone. So it's nice to get a confirmation and, you know, just another like, oh yeah, that's right. I did have that realization this morning. Let me stay with that. Let me hold on to that rather than these thoughts that things need to change.
Yeah, it's good to have the reminders. And it's good to, if you're having that kind of insight in the morning, it might be good for you to, you know, write them down or speak them into an audio recorder and have them there, because you're probably tapping into some wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I do have a journal beside my bed, and I used to write in it almost every morning, or at least whenever I would have like a realization and insight. And I've kind of gotten out of the habit. I mean, if it's something like hugely major, I will probably do it, but it is good. It is good because then I can go back and I can remind myself. But when I was doing that regularly, what I found was that I was just coming back around to the same realizations over and over and over again. It's like I'd forget about them and then they would come back and I'd write about them again. I'd be like, wait a minute. And I'd realize that, yeah, two notebooks ago, I wrote about this very thing, you know. So I don't know if anyone else has that experience, but, and I don't know if I'm just getting it at a deeper level or it truly is just a forgetting and a remembering, but I found that I just keep coming around, you know, and then I get to a point where I feel like, well, I can't go any further than this, like, this is it. You know, it's like, okay, I'm done.
Well, and some would say that, you know, the enlightenment process is nothing more than remembering, actively remembering and observing those very simple truths more and more throughout. You know, enlightenment is not this badge that you earn. It's this in-the-moment awakening.
Mm-hmm.
It's the truth of being alive and awake and aware and living from direct observation in every moment. It's not an accomplishment. It's a moment-to-moment experience. And some would say it's only achieved by going back to the basics in every fresh new heartbeat moment.
Sure, if you think it's an accomplishment, then how can you be enlightened right now, happy right now? You can't. You think you're going somewhere, but it's really not going anywhere. You're just waking up to the truth. That's it. It's a journey of zero steps. I just find it so amazing, you know. I mean, so it's amazing, but I find it so funny, amusing. That's the word I was looking for. Amusing.
That's another of the keys that a lot of people talk about, is that being able to find the amusement and being able to let go of that programmed response of taking myself so seriously. That's essential.
Yeah, and I have practice in laughing, so I think that might have, you know, I think that was very beneficial for me to go through that. I used to run a laughing meditation group, and we would laugh about nothing. We wouldn't like try and make ourselves, you know, find something funny to laugh about. We would just laugh for prolonged periods of time. And it was amazing how it's really just like doing a meditation, because you're so in the moment, because the laughter feels so good. And then, you know, it's like I had so many experiences of just laughing and then just, boom, I get the cosmic joke, and then I'm laughing so uncontrollably. You know, so, and yeah, I had the realization during one of my bouts of laughter that nothing is inherently serious. It's only serious if we take it that way. And
yeah,
that one brought me such joy.
Well, I appreciate the call and then the comments and the questions and the laughter. And I will look forward to the next time we get to chat. So thank you for the call.
Right. Thank you.
I realize that we're down to our last couple of minutes here, so I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tam. Appreciate it.
Have a wonderful show.
Thanks. So, welcome everybody to Mind Shifters Radio, the second hour. Today is Monday, April the 12th, 2021, and our calling number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. And we're waiting on Michael to get signed in, and I see a hand just went up, so I'm going to go ahead and click on area code 520. You're on the air. Who do I have?
Yes, this is Audrey.
Hey, Audrey. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
I can go ahead and talk with you, or if you want to wait until Michael gets signed in, and then you'll be caller, whichever you would prefer.
Oh, we can talk, and then when Michael comes in, and we can get dialing in now.
Yeah.
Hey.
Okay. How's things going?
Oh, it's going better and better when I work the program.
Yeah.
Mhm. Yeah. And when I'm consciously aware of working it, and there has been a big change since November. But, you know, I had a little fall, you know, a psychological fall, but I came out of the hole, and it's all good.
Awesome.
So
and
my,
I think
my
Michael
offering,
came in at the tail end of that.
Yeah, and my offering for you is you didn't have a fall at all. You had, if you think back to before what you're calling the fall happened, you hit a whole new level of vitality. And when you hit that new level of vitality, you can then dig into the next layer of what you need to work through. And that looks like a fall because you go back into those old symptoms. But if you keep using the tools and working them, then you find that that was really an upgrade. It gave you an opportunity to process a deeper layer of hidden information and let go of a load. And then as you do that, you come up the other side and you're still higher than that new high level. So you're right on track with it. That's the process. It takes some time to understand that.
Yeah. Absolute sense and a wonderful explanation for me. And I called in. I have a few questions.
Great. Let's go for it.
Okay. Since thought, I've written it down, so I'm going to write it. Read it. Since thoughts are things, thought forms, energetic patterning, and it's always in E-motion. As I process my worksheet, then is there a shift from the conscious mind, from the subconscious, from one to the other, conscious and subconscious, as I do the worksheet?
Okay, well, let's introduce a different concept here. There are three levels of functioning of what we call the body's mind. There's conscious, what you're aware of in a given moment. And then there's subconscious, which is what you are not aware of, but can become aware of at any time. For instance, right now you have subconscious information about the color of your car. So I say, Audrey, what color is your car? Those brain cells fire, and you have full access to them. You go, my car is blue or white or red or whatever it happens to be. So conscious and subconscious are changing places continuously. If I said, what's the front door of your house look like? What's your favorite item of clothing? You're not thinking about the color of your car, quote-unquote thinking.
Right.
And, of course, it's not thinking at all. It's just resonating information. The next level and what the work is about cleaning up is we have this veil. In the ancient teachings, they said the veil of the temple must be rent in twain. And, of course, they translate it for the lower mind as a purple curtain in a church. But the veil is literally the barrier between the subconscious and the unconscious. Now, the unconscious, I would offer, is an unnatural condition. It's a way of hiding or dissociating from content in our minds that we don't want to look at. And the way that we do that is by talking about how somebody else is the problem. See, they made me mad. Now, when I say, you made me mad, I take my mad part of my mind, which a moment ago was subconscious and I could access it, and I hide it from myself. I create an artificial barrier that makes that part of my mind impossible for me to access. So I've dissociated from that part of my mind, and I've created this unnatural, unconscious condition. So then,
Michael, wait, just stop
go
a
ahead.
Moment. Please, this to me, I don't process that quickly. Could you just speak a little bit slower, and I'd appreciate it because I'm trying to follow this concept.
Of course.
Thank you.
Of course.
Okay, go,
okay.
Please. Yes.
And it's just building brain cells, and then there'll come a point where it'll just go click and be, oh, well, that's so obvious. So again, when I go into denial, I say, when I talk to Audrey, she made me mad.
So
I just said to my mind, well, let's ferret this out. When I said, you made me mad, I entered into denial. Our definition of denial, when I think or speak as though something outside of me is a cause of what's going on inside of me.
Right.
And when I do that, I demand of my mind that my mind produce a picture that Audrey's the cause of my mad.
Mm-hmm.
And to produce that false picture, I have to hide the truth from myself. I have to make the truth my mad's about me. It's not about you at all. You may have triggered it, but it's mine. But I have to hide that truth from myself in order to believe that you're the cause of that mad or whatever else I'm blaming somebody for.
Okay.
So I just created that unnatural condition.
Uh-huh.
That's the unconscious. What forgiveness does, and that, I mean, we've been trained as non-humans to do that all our lives. You made me mad. You made me sad. You hurt me. That upset me. They disturbed me. The world situation causes me so much pain. You know, all of that's denial and creates an unconscious condition in my mind. It creates a set of brain cells that I can no longer access directly.
Right. Okay.
So what the forgiveness process does is, and the genius of Yeshua to have understood this and brought this to the world is monumental to understand the mind on this level. I mean, psychology hasn't even started to scratch the surface of how the mind works. Not even close. Yeshua, 2,000 years ago, knew exactly how to access and clean up the unconscious. You enter into the forgiveness process, and what happens is when I have dissociated content, you know, I'm pointing my mad at you because you didn't do this. You didn't fulfill a goal I had for you.
Mm-hmm.
I use that unconscious part of my mind, those hidden brain cells, to build my brain's false image of you, perception, a construct of my mind, that really shows me that you're the problem in my life. When I look into and realize that in order to do that, there's a goal that I had for you that you're not fulfilling for me. And I cancel that goal, that perceptual construct that is a reflection of unconscious data collapses. And when it collapses, it collapses in on itself. Now I've got access to my unconscious again. And I can clean it up.
I bring that
unconscious data, that dissociated content, forward in the presence of love. And in the presence of love, a transmutation, healing occurs. Now I've taken that out of the unconscious realm. And so it no longer flares up and runs my mouth every time somebody triggers or trips across that part of my mind. So now I get to function as a fully conscious being, and I return that information to the subconscious level of mind, so I have access to it anytime I want.
Okay, so that false belief, that thought disorder, then gets transmutated, okay? So then it goes back into the into, and then when something is triggered, I don't project and react as I did, correct?
Correct. I de-energize. When I brought that unconscious information with all its rage or sadness or fear or whatever forward in the presence of love, I de-energized that. I transmuted that energy, and now it's just another piece of information in my mind. So now along comes Audrey, triggers that mad part of me, and instead of you made me mad, I go, oh, Audrey, you just triggered that. I guess I have still a little more work to do on this angry part of my mind. And I realize that I have this thought disorder and I can become conscious of what's in my subconscious. It's not hidden from me anymore. And so I can simply clean it up. I can simply correct those thought disorders. And I don't have to play the game of blaming everybody else around me when that happens. I just become a lot more fun person to hang out with, you know, when I look in the mirror or I'm with anybody, because I'm not doing that blame game anymore in order to keep my unconscious out of awareness, to keep it hidden away.
Gain awareness. I gain enlightenment the process, and as I do the process, I gain more joy.
Precisely.
Okay.
I can't gain more joy than I have
because I'm already
in my created beingness. I just have gotten rid of that which dampened down and hid my joy under this dissociated hostility or fear. So
right.
I just make it more available to me. I mean, I was given a full measure. Everybody at creation, everybody at birth was given a full measure of joy. And if
right.
they hold a lot of unconscious hostility and fear, then that joy is covered up by the movement of hostility or fear and the blame of others. When I do the work, I free myself of that. And what shows up instead of unconscious hostility or fear blocking, you know, if you listen to the Course in Miracles, it says you need not seek for love. You need only seek, find, and release the barriers you built against it.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that's what you're doing when you do forgiveness.
Right.
So if you've uncovered what's always been there and how has always been yours.
Right. Because like when I'm talking to myself as I'm talking to you. So when source energy upon all the creation, okay, we all are sharing in the equanimity of joy. There is no less.
Exactly.
There is no more. It just is. Correct?
Correct. Yes,
on
exactly.
On a full measure.
Yes.
Okay. And as the worksheet is done and the inner work is done, those blocks are dismantled. They are transmuted. And it goes back, and the joy replaces that block. Is that what you're saying?
Precisely.
Okay. Now I have another question. In my genetic patterning, okay, similar to a mother duck imprinting her patterning on her little ducklings,
right?
Those beings before me in my genetic line, as I do my inner work and I dismantle the thought disorder and bring forth in that thought disorder by dismantling that, and it is joy, then these beings that are in spirit, because we all are bodies and spirit, right? We're all spiritual beings. Then as my forgiveness process happens, I release those who are still in that patterning.
My take would be that you can't force them to make
right.
the shift. But as you do the work around the energetic dynamics that they introduced into the bloodline maybe 2 or 10 generations ago, as you do that piece of work, my take is you open the energy window that makes it easier for them to walk through it. You can't force them to go through the door or
right,
the window, but you've opened it. So it's correct. But you've opened it. So it was for them perhaps totally an unconscious dynamic that they just had no idea how to break through. You come along 2 or 10 generations later and you open it and you clean it up and you've just opened the energy window that makes it easier for them to step through it, free them from it. And in fact, in the ancient teachings, that was called praying for the dearly departed. Praying, you becoming the space of love, doing your work, opened the energy gate for those who had gone before us and didn't know how to deal with what was going on in their lives. Just passed it along.
Right. Well, thank you for the explanation of praying for the dearly departed, because I had words, but I did not understand the concept. But I heard you talk about it before, but I didn't understand it at the level that I understand it today.
Sweet.
I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And, you know, if you remember in Aramaic, the word prayer means not get down on your hands and knees and tell the Creator what the Creator should be doing for you today. It's not about putting your order into the cosmic gift catalog, as the Greeks have interpreted it. The word prayer in Aramaic means to set a trap for God. God being love, the energy field in which we live, move, and have our being, we are designed to resonate with, capture that energy of love that we're moving through, and reflect it live in the world. That's prayer. So if I have a particular issue that comes from five generations back or two generations back or imprinting from mom when I was two, as I do my forgiveness work around it and enter into that space where I am presencing the active love of God in me, and I bring forward that untoward energy, that's where the transmutation takes place, and I have opened the space for the dearly departed.
Thank you. And Michael, could you, because you're such a wonderful person who it's a wonderful explanation of these words, could you expound on the word transference?
Well, if you go through all the videos from the codependence intensive, we'll talk a lot about, although I don't particularly use the word transference, I use more the word projection. But for me, the concept of transference would be you and I interact, and I bring up, let's say, dissociated fear in you. So I resonate the fear brain cells in your unconscious.
Right.
You've dissociated from, so you can't access them directly. And so your mind automatically uses that unconscious information to build its brain's image of me. So the very dissociated content that I've resonated in you, you use to build a picture of me. That, to me, would be the transference that happens. So now I show up in your perceptual construct as the cause of what you've dissociated from.
Right.
Because your unconscious is using that information to build its brain's image of me. So I would classify, to me, it's more clear to say than that is projection. And so, and our culture teaches that projection is taking something that's inside of us and putting it outside of us. That really isn't projection at all. Projection is taking something that's inside of us that we've dissociated from and using it to build our brain's image of them. So they show up in our mind with our problem attached, and we're sure it must be their problem. But here I am feeling it and experiencing it again. So that would be how I would categorize transference. It's really projection. And then, you know, if you listen to last week's shows, we've been talking about the chapter in the book on projection and externalization. So once I've got that picture, that construct that I now call Michael, it's got nothing to do with Michael. It's my brain's projection on Michael, according to what he resonated in me. Then when you externalize that and you pretend that that picture inside of you is outside of you, then you externalize it. And that together, those two pieces would be my definition of transference. And you mentioned in your note, counter-transference. So then when you tell me that I'm the problem in your life and that triggers my insecurity that I haven't dealt with, then I use my insecurity to build my brain's image of you, and the way I protect against my insecurity is to degrade you. So now I tell you about how crazy you are to dare to tell me that I'm the problem in your life. And now we've got counter-transference. You know, now we've got two people playing the same game.
Oh, thank you. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's wonderful that this program has a replay, because it's like I'm a cow chewing its cud. I take the little bite, like your explanation now, and then I could listen on a replay. And thank you. I don't want to take up somebody else's time, but thank you.
You're not taking up anybody else's time. You're not taking up anybody else's time. This is your time. And as long as you have thoughts and questions, we're here to chat with you about it. So, you know, that's absolutely perfect. And yes, it's something you can listen. We can each listen to many times.
Thank you. One other question. I was reading, and I don't know if this is right or not, but I was reading that the average person has approximately 50,000 plus thoughts per day, and some of those thoughts are the same patterning thoughts over and over again. So actually,
right,
we don't have new thoughts. We pattern those old thoughts. Correct, Michael? Or not?
Yeah, they're not even thoughts. They're like you were just talking about with the radio show. They're just replays of content.
Ah, okay.
They're not thoughts at all. Just replays.
With the nine-bit mind.
Yes. And some of those replays are just bits of genetic information, you know, all kinds of stuff moves in the mind. And if I realize my mind doesn't have clarity about something and I do my work, I get to clean up those bits of data that just kind of flow through randomly. And we believe them just because they're moving in our minds. You know, don't believe everything that you appear to think. And realize that a lot of what we call thinking is not thinking at all. It's just resonating old content over and over and over again. I love what David Bohm says about that. He says that many people think they're thinking when all they're doing is rearranging their prejudices.
Ah, thank you. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Ah, the problem in my life wasn't Bill, it was Harry. It's Hortense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank
and so
you.
To continue cleaning up. And on Saturday, we did an extra session in the Codependence Intensive, and it was communication practicum.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck and Magda from the Intensive did just a beautiful demonstration. It's one of the best captures that we've gotten on the responsibility communication tool, and it fits right in with this whole conversation. I mean, it was just, I am so excited to now have this in our archives. And what we're going to do is Gene's going to set up a link and put it in the notes. Of course, you've got access to it because you're part of the intensive. It was Saturday's, and Jeannie would have sent an email out to you with a link to it. And we're going to set a link up for anybody that's listening to the radio show that will be available for 2 weeks. Jeannie's going to put it in the notes. It'll be available for 2 weeks for anyone else who's not part of the intensive. It's such an important piece of work that we're going to put it in there so it's available for 2 weeks.
It's already
freely
in the notes.
Oh, there you go. And so that'll be there for anybody that's listening to the show. If you just go to the notes today, there's a link to that two-hour video. And then it's going to become a part of our video catalog, an extension of the communication. Did you hear what I think I said? Workshop. So, but that will expand brain cells on this whole topic again to a whole other level.
Okay. And the drawing you had with the nine bits,
yes,
you know, the little boxes and the nine bits of our memory.
Right.
Take one little block out of the nine, like nine squares, take one square out because that got cleaned up. Okay. That was transmuted. Okay. Does then another block move in its place?
Well, I would put not in so much terms of blocks, but bits of information. And if I clean out, let's say I've got some rage in some brain cells that I project into my brain's image of you, I do a forgiveness process around you, of course, realizing that I'm working with cleaning up my own mind. And I touch into that rage. I bring that rage forward and process it with love. Then rage is gone. And so now, in my perception of you, I'm going to be free of that rage. When I'm free of that rage, there's then room for me to see differently. An example that comes to mind, this is a real-life example. We had a young man at Heartland several years ago. He actually was on the support team for a couple of years. And when he came to Heartland, he was in his early 30s. He had not drawn a straight or sober breath since he was 14 or 15. He started smoking, drinking, and doing drugs at 14. And up to 34, 35, when he came to Heartland, he had not drawn a sober breath. He had deep hatred for his father, just outrageous hatred for his father. There was nothing good about his father, and they had spent years, as this kid was doing alcohol and drugs, in trauma with each other. The second year he was at Heartland, he was doing a still point breathing session. And he shared with the group after his still point session that all of a sudden he had this experience of himself being energy and his energy field reaching deep down into the earth, like he had roots in the earth energetically. He felt that. He experienced that. And out of that space, all of a sudden he had a spontaneous memory come of being a small child under two and his father laying on his back on the floor, holding the child up, playing with him. It was the first memory keyed to love that he'd ever had of his father. And that just opened the floodgates of the ability to be in a space of love with his father. He actually left Heartland when that summer season ended and drove straight back home and made amends with his father and cleaned his relationship up with his father. So, yeah, it changes our whole perceptual construct when we clean up underlying dynamics. It changes our whole perceptual construct about everything and makes space for things that otherwise are blocked.
Ah, thank you so very much. I mean, I'm gaining so much. As I do my work, I'm gaining so much. Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
That's the whole idea, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sweet. And I acknowledge your willingness to have allowed yourself to go into that level of healing process and move through the pain and the trauma that you were able to move through to just allow yourself to be with it. Yes, sometimes we get trapped in it a little bit and lost in it, but that's just a temporary step. As you keep doing your work, you clean up that data and everything changes. So, nice work.
Nice. Sweet. Blessing.
All you. Right. Well, any other thoughts for you, young lady?
Thank you. None right now. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you and delight in having you on our support team and delight in supporting you. And thanks for opening the energy of your window on another level for this healing process to be taken globally.
Thank you.
All right. Blessings. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Miss Jeannie.
We have another hand up.
Anything else happening? Oh, well, let's say hello then.
Okay. Area code 205. You're on the air. Who do we have?
This is Joan in Birmingham.
Well, hey there, Miss Joan.
Good day.
It was interesting to be watching in WhatsApp today. I didn't remember. I think I knew. I think you had mentioned it before, but I didn't have the detail of, you know, the time that you'd spent in Thailand. It sounds like it was pretty exciting time in your life and quite a broadening experience.
Life changing, to say the least. It was amazing.
Really coming
amazing.
From a little town in southern Arkansas to Bangkok, Thailand, and teaching English and learning the Thai language, that's pretty amazing, pretty sweet.
Yeah, coal mining town in Alabama.
Right.
To Bangkok, Thailand. Yeah. And they wanted me to teach English at the American University. And if you think my southern accent is strong now, you should have heard me then.
So you were teaching southern English.
Exactly. But fortunately, I was a class in the Thai language to learn to speak Thai, and you know it's a language. And so by learning to listen to the tongue, I learned to hear my Southern accent. It was very interesting.
I wonder to a Thai ear what a Southern coal mining girl, what her accent sounds like speaking Thai. It's got to be interesting.
Right.
Did you speak Thai with a drawl or?
Well, because of their tones, one of the things I had to learn was not drawl vowels out.
Right.
You know, because a longer vowel would make it mean a different word.
Ah, okay.
So
interesting.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Very interesting.
Well, it was nice of you to share that with us through the WhatsApp.
Right. Very interesting to me because before I went to Thailand, I started reading about it. And over again, I would see these statements about how kind the Thai people are and how
right.
they had avoided engaging in wars going around them. And
right.
So I just thought, well, this is just people no matter where you go. But they were extremely kind, and a great example of it was I used to take the bus to school in the morning, but I would walk home, and it was probably about 10 or 15 blocks from the school to my house, and I had to go around or through this huge square at the intersection of two of the main streets in Bangkok. It was a structure there where the drivers would stop to honor the Buddha, and lots of activities went on in this square. So one day I was walking home, and this square, which is usually empty at that time of day, was packed with people, shoulder to shoulder. And there was a platform with the speaker, and people in the square had signs. It was obviously some kind of a protest.
Right.
And I was obviously, you know, from the West. I had on a mini skirt. My hair was dyed blonde. And so I'm walking through across the square and having to squeeze my way through saying, excuse me. And I probably knew enough to say excuse me in Thai.
Right.
And let me through. I went home, went into my apartment and turned on the news. And it was a demonstration against the presence of the U.S. military in Thailand.
Right.
And not one person through all those people was ever rude to me. Not one.
Yeah.
An amazing how kind they really were. So anyway,
human life,
the reason
awesome,
I called,
wherever you go.
Yeah, exactly. I asked my I think I told you that my daughter's been studying ADHD for about it and reading everything she can find on it, and I think she's had a counselor or a coach helping her develop some skills to manage her ADHD.
Right.
And so she's been sharing what she learns with me. Of course, a lot of these tools that she's being taught sound very familiar to me because of what I'm learning with you. So I
right.
asked her, would she listen would she listen to the PowerPoint presentation on YouTube by Bill Constantino.
Right.
She said, I said, about 30 minutes. And she said, well, if it's that important to you, let's set an appointment and listen to it together. And we got the video and comment on it and so forth. So we did that this morning.
Oh, wow.
And, yes, it was amazing. It was such a great experience. And, you know, she really appreciated the references. And she said, well, this is obviously valuable because it's scientifically based. And a lot of the psychologists today still haven't caught up with the science of how the ADHD mind works. Now, one of the beliefs she's chosen that is different from what I've chosen is she doesn't believe that the mind can be, the brain can be changed. It's not in general that it can't be changed, but this ADHD neurological feature cannot be changed. And or because of the two, I choose the belief that it's just energy. And of course, it can be changed.
Right.
But, you know, there's our last been learning and what I've been learning. It was just very, very affirming. So thank you for all the many disciplines you've studied, and thank you, Yeshua, for however you knew these things that you shared it.
For sure, I'm with you. And my thought comes that a perfect follow-up to watching that would be the invitation. I feel like the session we did on Saturday with Chuck and Magda is one of the most powerful pieces in the whole body of work in looking at language and how it works. So that might be another interesting one to share with your daughter and see what opens and, you know, expand the whole concept of energy and words, how words impact perception. And ADHD is just a way of perceiving, or at least what's called ADHD, is just a way of perceiving. And, you know, perception shifts when you engage in forgiveness. That's just the way it works.
Yeah. Yeah. I had that same goal because she and her husband are getting some counseling and coaching on how they communicate. And
right.
So I will definitely invite her to watch that with me.
Sweet.
Awesome. Anyway, I'm complete, and I just wanted to express my appreciation for all that I'm learning in these classes.
Sweet. That's awesome. And I have talked with Magda, and she's going to review the video a couple times, and we're anticipating there are going to be more questions for her, more clarification, and for everybody that was part of that extra intensive session. And so we're planning, we've had the conversation that we will do still another extra session on the intensive, specifically geared to her questions and anybody else's questions around that particular session and the responsibility communication tools. So if you would, and anybody else that was part of the intensive, if you weren't there on Saturday, you have in your inbox a link to that video. Give it a watch. And I mean, we got down to some of the really deep, nitty-gritty kind of stuff very powerfully, and I really appreciate Magda's willingness, Chuck's willingness to step in, and the fact that Magda has used that tool for many years and just a whole different level of clarification came out. And so if there are additional questions, please make notes as you watch it, and then we'll set up within the next couple of weeks another session to answer all those questions.
Awesome. Yes, I'll review it, definitely. Okay, thank you, Michael.
Okay, appreciate you. Blessings. Lots of love. Bye-bye. I do have a little difficulty, by the way, visualizing you in the miniskirt going through Bangkok. But anyway, different times.
Yeah.
All right. All right, you have a blessed day. All right, Miss Jeannie, do you have anybody else out there with your hand up in the phone queue?
No other hands up, no questions in the chat room, so I guess go to the reading.
Let's start to the book. Yeah, we're heading into page 54, the last page on the chapter, What is Projection Externalization, Chapter 9. And if you don't have a copy of the book, why is this happening to me again? It's out of print, so we can't sell you one. You can, because way back 20-whatever years ago, we published it. We spread tens of thousands of books around the country and around the globe. So usually Amazon has got a few of them online available, used, and so does eBay. So you can pick up a copy, usually for an embarrassingly cheap $2 or $3. So, but in any event, it's there. Yeah, there you go. And or you can just go to our website and download it free. So you can print it off yourself or read it on your computer, your phone, however that works. But we're heading into page 54, and we've been talking about this whole idea that we will tend to, in blocks of truth, defend the projected perceptual content of our minds based in our own hostility and fear issues. We will tend to defend it as, no, this is the truth, and I can prove that it's true about you, where when you really understand how the human mind works, the mind always reveals its own content first. So whatever shows up in your mind as a perceptual construct always tells you more about the content of your mind than the world you think you're looking at. And where there's any form of hostility or fear, disturbance or upset, then we know that that content's being projected into one's brain's image of others. And especially when one goes into resistance, you know, I don't want to do this. I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to feel this. I certainly don't want to go in and experience the root of this raw, unresolved, painful situation in my life. So now I'm going to make pictures about you and make excuses for why you're now the problem and I'm out of here. And that's just a part of the healing process. It's a normal part that shows up in everybody's process at some point or another. And we just invite people to keep breathing and do their work. So we're talking to Richard, the character in the book, about self-destructive behavior. And I offer him the thought, a clue that a self-destructive behavior is our treasure, that is, and I had just quoted to him the scriptural idea that said, where your heart is, there will be your treasure, your unconscious. So we'll defend the content of the heart, the unconscious content, the projected content. We'll defend it, oftentimes to the death. So a clue that a self-destructive behavior is our quote-unquote treasure is that we defend it, though it is harmful to ourselves and others. When you're out of harmony with the lawful, orderly process of life, and as a result, a behavior is producing disease. Richard, I suggest you do whatever is required to change it and stop looking for ways to defend it. I express my amazement and how people engage in behavior proven to produce destructive and defend their right to that behavior while insisting that doctors or government find a cure for them. So somebody does a disease-producing behavior, justifies it, makes it righteous, and in so doing, you know, you can watch it in whole communities, it creates disease, pain, trauma, and suffering. But they then expect somebody else to fix it for them, somebody else to take care of them while they go on doing the behavior. And it's just, you know, it's kind of silly. So notice, for instance, how many people drink to excess on a daily basis and keep searching for a way to cure their hangovers. The cure is simple. Stop the behavior. The problem with that solution for the average person is that with the defense mechanism out of the way, they'll have to confront and deal with their treasure. So whatever we've used to rationalize our behavior, if we, you know, when you look at that word rationalize, when we create these stories, we're lying to ourselves. And when we start telling ourselves the truth, you know, the basic principles we've been living by, like, you know, all women are like that, or all men are like that, or people do, you know, whatever that treasure is, whatever that thing is that we keep going back to in order to not have to look at and deal with that part of our own minds. When you start moving toward truth, then you have to deal with that basic precept that maybe you've lived your whole life by, and if there's hostility or fear, it's based in a lie. So ultimately, this work is about giving up all of our lies and beginning to use language, beginning to speak in a way that we tell ourselves and express with honest, clear language, responsible language, what it is that's going on. And as we come out of blockage of truth, stress goes up. So when one's living in blockage of truth, what's the simplest example of that? You made me angry. Now, you know, every time in my life I've been angry, I'm the one who's been there. You can't make me angry. You might trigger my anger into activity, but you're nowhere near the cause of my anger. But when I say you make me angry, I create a principle that becomes my unconscious treasure. I have to be able to prove every time it happens that you're the cause of my anger. And I can't admit that every time I've been angry, I've been there and my anger is about me. That's what we mean by a treasure. And so when I am confronted with the truth of it, and it might be over and over again, that finally I go, okay, I'm going to let go of this belief, and I'm going to change my language. Instead of you made me angry, I'm going to shift my language into responsibility language, and that is, I notice that every time you do this, it brings up my anger, and I'm ready to start to own the fact that I have anger in my mind, and I'm ready to clean it up. Well, the stress of doing that is going to be enormous, but that's part of the process of healing. And if you're ever going to deal with one of these lies that you call your treasure, like the way you, you know, play your life out like it's somebody else's fault, then you start to process that hidden part of your mind. It can bring up a lot of stress because there are a lot of goals around that particular treasure, whatever it happens to be. And as I become willing to embrace the truth instead of telling my lies, then I begin to change everything in my world. And I'm going to get the process through, the pain that I've used that anger to anesthetize, because anger is not an emotion. Anger is a drug. So I say, you know, you're the cause of my anger. What happens is when you come around, you resonate a part of my mind that's got hurt in it. I don't want to feel that hurt, so I use anger as the drug to anesthetize my hurt. That hurt becomes my treasure, and I defend against it. I don't want to look there. I don't let anybody get close enough to it. But and in so doing, I perpetuate my disease process. So what we're looking to do with this work is to provide tools to process through those hidden parts of the mind and wake up to the truth of who we are as the presence of love. And it's an interesting process to come out of blockage of truth and to honor truth sufficiently to allow facts to stand as facts. We've heard in the political arena over the last couple of years, this one particular person coined this term, alternative facts, like there could possibly be such a thing. Alternative facts just mean I'm in blockage of truth, and so I'm going to put a whole different reality in this space that maintains a lie but keeps me pretending that I'm into truth. Now, it's a big stress for somebody to open that, and that's why we don't see it happen very often. And as one takes these tools in hand and uses them, it tends to become easier and easier and easier to just embrace those traumatized energies in the presence of love, process through them, and then just allow ourselves to be with the truth. So honoring truth becomes the lesson of this particular chapter that we're coming close to completing. And we've got about 10 minutes left, so we've got time for another conversation or two.
We have
Janine,
a hand
do we have
up.
Any... Oh, great. Let's say hello.
541, I think this is Celinda.
Hello, it is Celinda. How are you this fine morning, afternoon, your time?
We're wonderful. How are you, young lady?
Good, good, good. I got
you
in
have a
late
question
on the
for
show,
us?
So... Yes, I do. I got in late on the show, so I don't know if Doug and you had a conversation this morning or not, but I must mention to you.
Have not heard from Doug that, today.
Okay. What he came up with, any rebellion will get me killed, was exactly right on target for me.
Mm.
And so I'm very grateful for that sharing, that he was willing to be vulnerable and share that. And your mind shifter. It is safe, healing, and life-enhancing for me to surrender to authority, and it enhances my prosperity and safety. I had a really big aha when my mind was just turning that over. And
right.
The aha I had was that all of my life, I have built a relationship substitution file right on top of source, of my life source, and I put my mother there.
Uh-huh.
And that was, I realized, that's why it was, I just didn't want to surrender. Because I thought that source... would surrendering to source meant submitting to my mother's will.
Right.
And that just a big load fell off of me. So
nice.
I just wanted
nice.
To share that with you. I am really surrendering to love in relation to my Hydra as well, and I would like to share that with you, but that might take quite a few minutes, and we don't have time this morning.
We've got about 8 minutes
related,
left.
Okay. It's related to the journey in our 30 sailboat from Kauai to Coos Bay, Oregon in 1988, right after Larry and I were married. I never realized what a big hydra that was or what a big head of the hydra that was. Journey was... 2,496 miles. Larry and I were the only crew. We came so close to perishing several times, at least seven that I have listed.
Courageous journey. Wow.
I was terrified. I have to share with you that I had my eyes checked for nearsightedness for a new prescription right before I left. When we got to Oregon, I went into the DMV to get a driver's license and almost didn't pass it. That's how terrorized I was.
It changes your vision, your ability to see that much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, as a naturopath, you'll really relate to this. When I would go to urinate, it would be like thick, viscous coffee.
Hmm.
That's how terrified it was. And did I share this journey with you already about sailing across the ocean?
No, I haven't. Because
I didn't want to be redundant. Okay. That journey was a 2,496-mile journey. I just happened to look it up today. I've never thought to do that. It took us 32 days. During the time...
That's pretty fast. That's almost 100 miles a day.
Right. In a slug of a sailboat, no less. Yeah, it was
That's
not
amazing.
A fast sailboat. And I owe my life to Larry's skills. Because 4 days out, our mainsail ripped in half. He had just had it resewed.
Right.
And then after that, our radio equipment, which was brand new, failed.
Ouch.
And the Loran, that we were too far off shore for the Loran to be real accurate.
For it to read, right.
Yeah. Fortunately, Larry had taught himself celestial navigation when he was living in Oregon before. It was his navigation.
Breathing with you.
Yes. And then one day, I had just gotten off shift, and you change shifts very rapidly on the ocean because your life depends on it. So he gets up there, and there's a tanker coming towards us full steam ahead. And if someone hadn't noticed the radar, we wouldn't be here. And then another time, a seagoing tug, was tugging a barge.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever seen their cables, they're humongous.
Right.
And we were right between the tug and the barge. Fortunately, the tug saw us and stopped. So the cable couldn't sink. And then our propane went out. And if I hadn't squirreled away 24 boxes of Triscuits and bite-sized shredded wheat and mayonnaise and spirulina, or green, you know, super
food. Right. Sure, powder, right?
We wouldn't have had any food for several days before we got in to port. And then the last thing was, on the final couple of days, 2 or 3 days, there is an infamous storm that happens. Pardon?
We've got 1 minute.
Okay. Let's continue this conversation. There's let's continue it tomorrow morning. I should be free.
Yeah, I'll be interested in hearing the rest of the journey. That's pretty powerful. It makes me think about the movie. If you haven't seen it, it might be a good review to process and, you know, bring up any more energy around this whole thing that needs to be processed with the Contiki expedition. Powerful film if you haven't
seen
it.
I've never seen that.
Yeah,
I'll write
I find
that
it interesting.
Down.
But I'll look forward to hearing the rest of that tomorrow. That sounds like a really major life event that you've got some work to do around, and we're here to hold the space for it.
Oh, yeah, and it's taken me right down to the source head of the Hydra.
Sweet. All right, well, we'll look forward to continuing the conversation tomorrow. And in the meantime, everybody, have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. You can give it. The world needs it, and you deserve it. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio.
with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.